Radio Influence. The future is now. You are sitting ringside with David Penzer on Radio Influence.
Welcome to Sitting Ringside. This is David Penzer for another week of fun and excitement, talking about the professional wrestling business. So we hope you enjoyed last week's perusing through the career, the early career of Kevin Sullivan, the wrestler, and got some great stories on that. Appreciate any and all feedback, and want to introduce once again to talk WCW, Turner Broadcasting, and beyond. Because, you know, it's sort of a kind of a big deal. That they, something called, they call the Monday Night Wars. It's like one of the top things up there with the Montreal Screwjob and a couple other things. So I want to welcome back Kevin Sullivan. Kevin, extensive look at your career, the beginnings of your career through Jim Crockett Promotions last week. We appreciate your time. We appreciate you coming back for a second week. So I wanted to pick up pretty much around the time that that Ted Turner bought out Jim Crockett Promotions. Tell me your memories of the problems that were going on with Jim Crockett Promotions and, you know, leading up to the Turner buyout, what was going on.
It was the craziest thing, David, because we had, you know, this is when Crockett paid $1 million to McMahon for the TBS rights.
Yes.
Correct?
Correct.
And we also had, he opened up an office in Dallas. He had the Charlotte office, and he was buying, Crockett was buying the other territories. He bought Kansas City territory, the St. Louis territory. He bought the Amarillo territory, and he bought Watts' UWF territory.
And the Florida,
correct?
And the Florida territory, which we talked about. Last week.
Florida territory. So he had most of the territories split between him and Vince, and the only one left, I think, they were on their last legs, was the AWA.
And I think World Class, but they were pretty much done as well.
Yeah.
They were.
But I think that was World Class that joined with Memphis,
correct,
right?
Correct. I was just going to say that.
Yeah. And the AWA, they had nobody now, you know. Nick Bockwinkel had left. Hansen had driven over the AW belt. Hogan had left, the Sheik had left, who else had left? Bobby Heenan had left, Vachon had left, so they had almost nobody. So it was really between us and them. And we were still on at 605, but we ran a 96 and 97 day tour. You were on it, I believe, that time,
no, that was
the Grand Max.
No, that was before. I didn't come on until later on after.
Okay. Well, when we came to the West Coast, we made our home base in Vegas, and we would fly Vegas to Spokane back to Vegas at night on the Learjet, and then we would be flying to Seattle the next night back to Vegas. Then we flew to Portland, back to Vegas. Then we flew San Francisco, Stockton, L.A., Sacramento, back to Vegas.
I heard it was a big party. I've heard the stories before from Ric Flair himself.
Well, here's the one that got me, where I said, what am I doing? We were leaving that day. We were flying to San Diego, which was our longest trip in the East West Coast. And as I was going through the pool area at 5 o'clock, very few people there. The pilots had 4 naked girls and they were drunk. I started to worry if I had taken on enough life insurance policy. It was the most brutal tour I've heard about the plane ride for hell. We did it for 97 days, watching Rick walk up and down the aisle, you know, with his robot and nothing else.
Yes, sir. I've been there.
Yeah, you've been there, and, you know, God bless you, sir.
Actually, my wife got a shot of that one time in England, in a bar.
Oh, really?
In a bar in England, yeah.
God, so, yeah, you know, so it what happened was they were drawing huge money, but their accountant, for some reason, and to me, there had to be something felonious going on, David, because they never sued the accountant. Finally, we were drawing all around everywhere. The accountant came to him, Jimmy Crockett, and said, "We got a problem. We got enough money for 2 weeks to stay in business." Now, that's when the first contracts, Lex Luger got the first contract, the Road Warriors got the second, and Flair got his. Nobody could get more than him. He was special. If anybody got more, his money was raised. But we were flying from Charlotte on two planes, one a G7 or G9, I'm not sure, and we were flying, the other crew was flying on the Learjet. We were flying 90 miles from home. I used to drive. I'd be home before they would be.
Sure.
I mean, they wasted a lot of money. I don't have any bad feelings to the Crocketts, except sometimes because your father was a genius in a business doesn't make you a genius in the business. On the reverse, it certainly made Vince McMahon more of a genius than his father was.
Right.
So, you know, they killed their own goose. Would they been able to survive? Just think that if Jimmy didn't sell it to Turner and they kind of made a pact, and they opened up a school in Florida like they got now with some talented guys and maybe one in L.A. and with Crockett and, you know, Dusty's and the Mulligans and the Wahoos and the Ernie Lads and the smart guys, the Jimmy Cornettes, the Paul Heymans, throwing things in. They may not have beaten Vince, but they may be still in business. You know what I mean? There's, you know, more than one professional fight promoter in this country. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And I think that when we went away on Monday nights, it hurt them because of the competition. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It became, you know, I love The Undertaker, but maybe this 1 week I don't want to watch The Undertaker. I want to watch the NWO, and they're on the same segment. So, hey, the guy stayed fresh, too. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Right. It almost sounds like Crockett went out of business due to its own excesses. You know?
Absolutely. I'll give you a story, and you can ask JJ when we're down there for the dinner with you. We're in Vegas. That's the famous trip I'm telling you about. And JJ get a call to go to Crockett Suite. Dusty's up there. So I thought, this can't be good, right?
Right.
We're driving like crazy, but maybe something isn't what they like, and I'm probably the low man on the totem pole, so I'm going to be gone. So they bring me and JJ in the room. They have us sit down. You know, they say, "Would you like something to drink?" That's not usually the way that they wrestling people do business, but it's Vegas and the guys have been up all night. Right. Well, okay, I'll have a Chevis and JJ's gonna have his rum and coke. JJ says, Jimmy, what's going on? And Jimmy and Dusty look at JJ and say, Kevin, can you and JJ work together? James, can you work together with Kevin? And James and I are friends. He said, of course. He said, well, we're going to make you the booker, James, and Kevin, the assistant. And me being stupid, should have just shut my mouth, said, well, where are you guys going?
Oh, geez.
We're going to Hollywood to make movies. Their egos got so big, they were going to Hollywood to make movies. Could you imagine them walking into a studio and asking for a meeting with Martin Scorsese, Francis Coppola, Lucas, or on the acting side, De Niro, Pacino, Kevin Spacey? Can you imagine what was wrong with them? Too much success.
Right. So they run out of money, and eventually they sold to Turner. How was that as far as the guys? Were the guys happy about that at that point? Were the guys upset about that? How were the office and the talent? How did they react?
I've told this story only twice. One was to JJ, and one was to a dear friend of mine. When they bought the company, when Turner was buying the company, the boys became flippant. How are they, TBS, how are they going to be able to run a company, right? What do they know about wrestling? Well, I didn't see it that way. I saw it, well, they just bought a company that has wrestling on it, and they're going to promote the shit out of it to get ratings. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And this is before the Monday Night Wars. So the guy that was the acquisition guy, I'll never forget his name, was Blair Underwood. He came to me and he said, listen, you've been the only guy that treated me with respect. Everybody else has looked down at you. I said, I'm sorry that you did that. I think you're just trying to do your job, and I think it's going to be good for the wrestling. And Barnett pulled me aside, and you know, Jim, oh, my boy, right?
Yes.
And he gave me a huge compliment. He said, you see the future, and they don't. We're going to be either working for TBS or we'll be out of business because Jimmy doesn't have the money. So then they brought in Jim Herd, the first disaster, and the disaster. I could tell you story after story about it, you know, because his station produced wrestling from the Chase, so they figured he knew something. It was ridiculous. One of the greatest ribs I ever pulled was on Jim Herd. And when I did it, Jimmy Cornette ran to the bathroom. I followed him, and he started screaming at me. He says, he's going to do it, you know. He's going to do it. And he was laughing and joking. You want to hear it?
Is that the Ding Dong?
No, that's the Hunchback.
The Hunchback. That was my second choice.
Yeah, where I told he says, first of all, he wanted to change Ric Flair into Spartacus and put diamond earrings on and buzz his head, right?
Yeah, I heard that.
I said, well, why don't we just go to Yankee Stadium and take down 3 and change Babe Ruth to number of 47 and redo his records? And that, I didn't get along with Hurt.
I don't think anybody did.
No, nobody did. And then he came up with the Ding Dongs. You remember them with the little bells by the end of the
yes.
match. There was nothing but bells, and they'd have to ring the big bell. So one day, he hated Cornette. So I would sit beside Cornette, and I would nudge him, Jimmy, all the time. Because Jimmy would start smiling, and then he'd go from smiling to being pissed, you know?
He took it serious.
Because he's a serious wrestling person.
Still is.
And I believe, and I think I am too. But I saw that this was never going to work. And I thought eventually, because if we just let this guy do what he does, in 3 weeks he'll be out. Little did I know that the other people that were observing it knew less than him, right? So when he says to me, Corny, and I'll never forget how he looked at us, because he said, you know, you were the wrestling people. He said, but I came up with an idea that even you wrestling people will like it. I said, what is it, Jim? He said, we're going to have a team that's never going to lose, a tag team, and they're going to be world champions forever. And Cornette says, what are you talking about? And I says, yeah, Jim, how are they going to stay world champions forever? He said, there's going to be hunchbacks. So they can never be pinned because their shoulders won't be on the mat, right? So Cornette turns red.
I could see it like I was there.
You know, David, I know you can. He's ready. He's taking his glasses off when he's going to get in a street fight. And he's ready to explode. And I said, this is my time where I'm going to calm him down. And I said, Jim Herd, that's the greatest idea I ever heard. I said, but I got one that's going to top it. I said, we'll eventually get the rock and roll so hot because these guys are going to beat them all the time. We'll go to Turner Field. You remember when it was downtown?
Yes, sir.
The ballpark was. I said, we're going to go to Turner Field for our bash of the summer. And I said, the main event is going to be the team that can't lose against the rock and roll. And they're going to offer their hair up. And he says, what the hell's the finish? I said, Robert's going to bring a shovel. And he's going to hit the opponent over the head with a shovel. And he's going to dig a hole. So his shoulders are level to the ground because falls count anywhere in the building. And Robert will beat him for the title. And David, he looked at me and said, that's why you keep your job here. That's brilliant. Cornette ran into the bathroom. I followed him. And Jimmy was half between going to choke me, pee on me, or throw laugh boogers all over me. He said, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen, but the stupid bastard is going to do it, you know. And then it hit me. I said, holy shit, he is going to do it. Yeah. I ribbed myself into it, you know what I mean?
Well, thank God he didn't do it. Somebody stopped him.
Yeah.
So you were on the booking committee, obviously, coming up with great ideas like hair versus a team that'll never lose, Matt. And now I was there. I wasn't there when the Ding Dongs were there, but I was there when Oz debuted. Was that a Herd thing?
Yes and no. Herd wanted to bring it up to date, but you know, Dusty was a great guy, but sometimes if you didn't fit in with Dusty and you could be looked upon as a threat, you could, your career could be stopped quickly. Here's a 7-foot bodybuilder, Kevin Nash, just won Mr. Atlanta. Now, at the time, he wasn't the greatest worker, but neither was Goldberg, and the guy was had a better body at 7 feet than Goldberg did.
Right.
So they built, you know, the thing, Oz in the background, which cost $100,000 back then. Janie Ingalls, we both love her. She's Dorothy. She's going down. We got the Cowardly Lion. And he's Oz, Kevin. Spray painted his hair gray. He was a young kid. He was 25 years old. They got me in a rubber mask. And I'm carrying a monkey, right?
And that's why I bring it up, because that's one of the funniest things I ever seen. PETA will be all over us, but the monkey thing. Yeah. I had to bring the monkey story up. So go ahead. You're carrying the monkey.
Excuse me, PETA. I didn't mean to do it. I'm carrying the monkey's on a leash, and he's jumping, and he's humping my leg, and I push him down. He's humping my leg, push him down. Well, we're about to get in the ring. And the monkey jumps off the walkway. There was a walkway to the ring built.
Like a stage.
Yeah, so high. So he jumped off the ring, just yelling at us, get in the ring, get in the ring. I snatched the monkey, and I snatched him too hard. He's dead. So I'm dragging a dead monkey around the middle of the ring. You talk about something not getting over. And I believe the money they spent on Kevin was they could go back and say, we spent all this money on the guy and he didn't get over. Then they went to Vinnie Vegas with Diamond Dallas Page as his manager and he couldn't get over. And he told Eric that he was quitting the business. Vince snatched him right up, right?
Sure. Made him a star.
Made him not just a star, but he started him out as a bodyguard, which was great for Sean, right?
Right.
They could even get more heat with Kevin just standing there because he didn't jump on. He did the old Gary Hart heel. I think he learned that from Gary Hart. Kevin and I used to ride together when he was younger. And I would tell him, if the baby face is pissed off at you, fuck him. That means you're getting over. And I didn't mean it to insult the baby faces, but in that era, David, you know better than anybody, they all were egomaniacs. You know what I mean? And they wanted it to be theirs. But, okay, they took Kevin and spent, we'll say, $150,000 on his entrance. Then they made him Vinnie Vegas. Then they were having him do jobs. Then Vince makes him a star, makes him the world champion. He comes back with Hall, Nash, and Hogan in six-pack. And they drew the most money until Steve Austin.
We're gonna get to that, but yes, sir. And not to mention, you talk about Kevin with you know the body and the looks and the size and all that. He's also one of the funniest, naturally funny guys in the world. So
and
you know,
I just texted him the other day because he was coming out of the hospital.
I saw that,
and I said, I miss talking to you because I can talk with you about wine. About the 68 Detroit Tigers. I can talk to him about Don Larson's 1956 perfect game. I can talk to him about what is the Freudian part of Moby Dick. He's a brilliant guy.
He's a very smart, funny guy. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And he would come down every year and visit me and stay at my place at the gym. He would come to the gym. He stayed at a hotel, but he would come by and we'd have dinners and he'd take us out to dinner. He's a smart, smart guy. Why he isn't being used for as talented and smart as he is beyond me. It just baffles me. But up until that time, right, you know, we were kicking ass and Steve Austin came, and then, you know, things different. But I want to say something right here now, okay?
Okay.
Everybody says Nash, Hall, Hogan, right? And they all talk about DX. Who's the only guy that's in both of them?
X-Pac.
He's a guy that's overlooked. He was the cog in the machine that made that machine work. You looked at Kevin Nash in your mind. You're saying, I can't beat up that 7-foot guy, right?
Right.
You looked at Hulk Hogan. I can't beat Hulk Hogan. You looked at Scott Hall, who looked like Tarzan. I can't beat him up. But I think I can beat this kid up, right? And do you remember when he was doing the thing way ahead of time with the phone? And he was filming shit with the phone?
I just remembered that. I had forgot it. You're right.
Yeah, and do you remember, you know, the ambulance ride they talked about, right? Was it, they were just saying, oh, it's controversial?
Right.
X-Pac drove the Steiners off the road and flipped the car.
That's right.
X-Pac was involved in so many angles that didn't get the credit. And I think it is, he never banged his own horn. And the other thing is the stature. If you look at him, unless you know the business, you don't think. And that was back in the day of big guys. You don't understand how this little guy carried. Remember the famous Ric Flair parody?
I'll never forget it because I had to ride from the arena to the hotel with Arn then. He was not a happy camper. And that's a shoot, and you know it.
Oh, I know it's a shoot. I got something to tell you. Kevin, he approached Kevin because I saw Arn, right? And Arn said, how could you do this? My wife called me. And when he's talking to Kevin, he has two beers in each hand and two beers in his pocket. And the cooler came from Arn's back seat, you know what I mean? But the thing about the parody was the greatest line I ever heard in wrestling. The parody was when he was crying, X-Pac, right?
Right.
And he said, I have no reason to know why I'm crying. I'm just crying. they were so cool, David. It's at a time we will never probably see again. I mean, there'll be things as big as NWO, but they hit lightning in a bottle. I see some of the young kids today, and I don't want to mention their names because I don't want to think I'm knocking them, but they're giving the wolf pack signal. You know what I mean?
I know who you're talking about. Yes, sir.
Too sweet. Come on. That should be trademarked.
Yeah, I agree. So, back to that angle, I know we jumped ahead, but going back to that angle with the parody, when, you know, I rode with Arn, you know, for probably 5 years, 6 years, every trip almost. And
one of the most wonderful human beings on the face of the earth.
Yes, I love him like a brother and his family. Yeah. And but he would, you know, look, let's be honest. First thing when he landed. He would go to, you know, we'd rent a car, he'd go to the 7-Eleven or whatever it was, get a styrofoam cooler, a case of beer, and a bag of ice. And then when he started riding with me, we had to hit the liquor store after that so I could buy my bottle of vodka. So, hey, I'm coming clean too.
And the ephedra to get a good workout.
Yeah, yeah. So when I saw, I didn't realize that he was fuming in the back, but I'm outside as the ring announcer. I'm sitting outside the ring. I'm watching this go down. I don't know what to expect. And I see him walking with the cooler and I popped. I laughed like a son of a bitch because that was him. I mean, you know, I know he was angry because his family, he didn't necessarily need his young kids and his wife to see, you know, them mocking, you know, his routine. And I get it. I understand.
But if he's a baby face, it was And I hope Arden doesn't hold us against me. What it was at the time, it might have been too close to home.
Yeah.
But heels are supposed to get heat. And they got heat because they did cool shit. You remember when they would drop pamphlets from the roof of the building?
Yep.
You know what I mean? And you know, people always talk to me, how were they get along? Most shows, you were there in Orlando, right, where the cops came. They thought it was real.
Absolutely.
That was the first time I ever heard of a script. I passed the scripts out to everybody. They never questioned me about, would my character do this? You know, we got along famously. I was shaking my head yes to them when I was saying, whatever you do, do not use baseball bats. Do you understand this? Heat is going to come down. I've told you not to use baseball bats. The thing was so violent, they didn't even mention the baseball bats. You know what I mean? Right. And those guys, you know, everybody talks about, oh, they didn't do jobs. I remember in Charlotte Coliseum, Figure Four or Nash, Pillman had Scott Hall in the finish, and Arn had dropped X-Pac and covered him. You know, those guys were business. They would question you on times,
yep.
But they were right to question sometimes.
Absolutely. So
yeah,
let's go back a little bit. An executive producer position opened up, this is after Bill Watts left. And I know that David Crockett put in for it. I know Keith Mitchell put in for it. I know Tony Schiavone, who was my boss at the time, put in for it. I think Gary Juster maybe put in for it. And Eric Bischoff put in for it. And basically what they had to do was write their vision of you know, World Championship Wrestling moving forward. And, you know, then they each got, you know, I think an hour or two to pitch it. And the big bosses made their decision. And I think pretty much everybody was surprised that Eric got it. Were you surprised that Eric got the job?
That was before me. I was there. I got in an argument with Herd. He let me go. And there was a great deal that he let me go, because I got a great deal in Japan, and I had a 2.5 year run. And how I came back, you'll find this interesting. How I came back, I was living in the Daytona when Tugboat crashed through as, what was he?
Shockmaster. The Shockmaster.
When he crashed through the Shockmaster, Eric called my house probably 12 seconds later and said, are you watching this? And I didn't want to embarrass him. I said, no, I just kind of fell asleep. I just got back from Japan. He said, this is horrible. Can you get a tape? I said, no. I said, I did see it, Eric. And he said, will you come and meet me for breakfast? And I met him for breakfast, and then Hogan was there. Not Hogan, I'm sorry. Rick was there, and Rick wanted me to be his assistant. So they offered me some money, and I said, well, I'm making more money than that in Japan, and I'm being off. And Eric said, Rob, this Japan is bullshit, that these guys can work this little one. And I was also, back in the day, wrestling in Florida was doing pretty well, David.
Right.
When I was off, I would go over on Tampa. They were running Tampa Tuesday. They ran Sarasota, a little town of Sarasota, Wednesday, and Newport Richey. And I was picking up minimum of $1,500, and everything was paid. My food, my rental car, everything. And if I wanted to, I could have gone home every night, you know?
Right.
So then when I came back, Eric put me with Rick, and that's the angle I came up with the people around ringside betting on, you know, the judges' scorecards when it went to the draw about Terry Funk. You know, the one I'm talking about, right?
Legendary angle, yes. One of my favorite of all time.
That was my angle, and Eric came to me and said, that angle was worth what I pay you. And I said, maybe it's worth more, huh? Well, just give me a bump. So I was always kidding with them. But we went right from Ricky Steamboat to Terry Funk, who had been non-existent in that company for a while, to selling out. And Rick was Rick, and he was probably right at close to his peak. And Terry is the most beloved and one of the best minds in the business, even though he plays the dumb Terry Funk routine sometimes. What are you doing? What are you doing? Where are you going next? Where are you going next? And then 10 minutes later, he'll be telling you what stock to buy because it's going to make a move, you know? So, yeah.
So when Eric goes in and pitches, and you know, everybody knows the story. Ted Turner said, what do we have to do to compete with Vince? And Eric, with his back against the wall, says, put me in primetime live. Were you the booker at that time? You were the head booker at that time?
Here's what happened. Right before I became head booker, Flair wanted to beat Hogan the worst way. First, he wanted to beat him, right? Then he wanted Vader to beat him. Then he wanted Sting to beat him. And at that time, Hogan was a babyface, right?
Right.
And if you remember, David, once Hogan came over, he was considerably smaller.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
His arms weren't as big as my arms. Not saying anything, but he was small. And he would even lean over because he was self-conscious. You remember that? His back was bothering him. And, you know, Jim Barnett and I were very close friends. And Jim came to me one day and said, we got to get rid of Rick. And I said, why is that? He said, he doesn't give a shit if it's George South, not disrespecting George South,
right,
who's a great, great performer, should be in the Hall of Fame, said he wants him to beat Hogan. It doesn't matter. He just wants Hogan to be beat. He said, and he'll get it from Eric because Eric was brand new at the time. He said he'll wear him down. He said, I'm going to suggest they put you in charge and just don't be worn down. But 2 weeks prior to that, we were in Germany. I don't know if you remember that. Was Germany and Switzerland tour we were on?
I wasn't on that tour.
Okay. And Hogan came to me and said, can you get us there? I said, I can get you to the promised land. I said, because look at who I have. Not only good WCW talent, but I have the greatest talent that Vince McMahon has made. So I got the new guys and Vince's talent that Vince made off of his TV. If I can't do something with this, maybe I didn't learn a thing, you know. So he said to Eric, I can't be fighting with Rick every week. He comes to me. That's when Hogan said, listen, Rick, I'm not putting you over. And that's when he said, well, you got to put Vader over. You know what I mean? And he didn't. We just had Hogan for the first time. What, are you going to beat him first time, you know, out? For, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
How could we possibly do that? So,
yeah, he was the biggest acquisition in the history of the company at the time. And probably ever.
Right. Right. And I was lucky there too, because, you know, if Jim Barnett, and you know, this was one of the smartest men, if not the smartest guy ever in the history of the wrestling business, had national TV in Chicago, in the Dumont Network with Fred Kohler. Then he had national TV with Vince Jr., remember?
Right.
First WrestleMania. Then he had national TV with Ted Turner. So, and he also had national TV in Australia. He was a brilliant, brilliant guy. And he didn't sugarcoat anything. And he said, we got to get him out or we're going to lose people because he's going to want to be the champion for. And he said, it's funny. He said, he's going to be one of the champion for the 16th time. And I think Rick is the 19th time or something.
So, you know, that was, correct me if I'm wrong, that was about the time that you started the Dungeon of Doom. And a lot of people rolled their eyes at the Dungeon of Doom and some of the characters and the craziness. But correct me if I'm wrong, and this is not inside knowledge, this is just my perception of being in the company, that was a way to placate Hogan, who was tired of Flair wanting to beat him all the time, to feed him a series of monsters, Kamala, John Tenna, and you were the taskmaster. Would that be accurate?
David, that's why I said when we started this that you're smarter than most guys just by osmosis. You understood, you know, the Dungeon of Doom. I had to get his trust because I knew he had to turn heel because the pop wasn't there. He didn't look the same. He was a bald-headed man who was thin at the time. You know what I mean?
Right.
And what turned me was one night in the old Chicago stadium, he went to make an interview, and Mean Gene, as great as he is, said, you can hear how the people here are very upset at what's going on. And they were booing Hogan out of the building. He would say they were pissed off at what was happening. Not just him, right? And I went after that match, I went to him and I said, you got to turn heel. He said, absolutely you're not. So I said to myself, I got to get him to trust me. And how do I do it? He fought comic book characters, right?
Right.
So now I have him fighting comic book characters, the Shark. God bless him. What a wonderful man. I have him against his good buddy, Brutus. I have him against Hugh Morris. I have him against Conan.
Kamala.
I got his Kamala. I got Jimmy Hart. I got King Curtis, who he absolutely loved. And I just fed him guys, you know, and I was feeding them guys each week because, first of all, it made him feel secure with me. It wasn't anything where he said, what are we going to do for a finish? It was big foot and a leg drop every night, right?
Yes, sir.
And until the NWO came, right?
Right.
And the talent underneath, the Benoits, the Guerreros, the Malenkos, the Perry Satins, the Troy Martin, Shane Douglas, they were having such great matches, and then you're having this cartoon at the end of it. You know, and my work went down then too because I wasn't working like I should have been. I had never backed off from a baby face in my life. I started backing off that this is the great Hulk Hogan. So it was almost where he started to see, oh, this is embarrassing. And then when the Kevin and Scott came in before six, right?
Right.
They got over instantaneously. And he saw how cool they were. And I'm going to tell you how smart Kevin Scott are, and you know it. Do you remember the black and white interviews we did where Hogan was kicking the earth ball around the globe.
Right.
And they were talking. That was Kevin and Scott's idea. If they, and it took Hogan on, he was great on one takes, as you know. It took Hogan to do the first take, maybe 8 takes, because he was so intimidated by those guys. If those guys wanted to bury Hulk, they could have that night.
And getting back, getting back to the point I wanted to make, and you explained it brilliantly, but the point I wanted to make was that, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful to wrestling fans. Without wrestling fans, none of us would be here, and that's an understatement. But I see it in my I have a 22-year-old son who's a wrestling fan, and sometimes he doesn't understand why certain things have to happen to get to a certain place. You might roll your eyes at certain things. I'll give you a quick example. I don't want to get into it too much because I know your time is valuable, and I want to talk to you more about your career as a booker. But when WWE gave the super lightning push to Jinder Mahal because they needed a Indian heel character because Indian character because their market research showed that the market in India was fresh to make tons of money, and the guy was ripped and you know he was under contract, and they put him with a couple of young guys and they gave him the Rocket, and you know. My 22-year-old son is like, "Wow, this is horrible. Why are they?" And I'm trying to explain that sometimes there's a bigger picture. And my point is that I know at the time wrestling fans, a lot of them, because I sat right sitting ringside, like the name of the podcast, and they would roll their eyes. Why are we rehashing the Hulk Hogan Superman beats the characters? This is horrible. This is stupid. This is dumb. But my point here is that I believe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that there would not have been an NWO without you gaining Hogan's trust by feeding him what he was used to for a period of time of the Dungeon of Doom. Is that correct?
David, he stayed at my house that night before with Peter Young, his agent. Peter cried to me that I couldn't turn him heel till 2:30 in the morning. We went to bed. I didn't come to the building, if you remember, till the match before. I didn't want him backing out. I had to get Jimmy. Everybody was telling him, don't turn. You know what I mean? Everybody didn't think it was going to work. It worked great because it also... People had said, well, I know he had Sting as backup. Bullshit. There was no backup. It was either that or the two of them were going to get killed. But the thing that reason why it worked, think who was in the ring. Diesel, Razor, and Hulk Hogan, New York against NWA. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And there's not a doubt in my mind, by the way, that if you would have left the without Hulk, he would have driven back to Tampa and blown it off. Because
I think so too.
But the bigger point, there had to be a Dungeon of Doom to gain the trust to get to the NWO, correct?
And that was it too, David. Up until that time, you know, when I used to wrestle, I would hit the ring full bore, you know, going full bore. And, you know, we were wrestling. We didn't become characters until he got there. It was me. It was Hugh Morris, which could be, he was a great performer at the time. Right. And I had Conan, I forget. Oh, Ming. And we were wrestling the Horsemen, and we was doing fours on a Friday, on a Monday night. So it did work, and his numbers, because he was Hogan, and because he was getting a lot of, you know, how much money he got on the pay-per-views.
Right.
But then when he saw, this new thing is going to go by me, and I'm going to become passe. You know, like people always roll their eyes and say, well, why didn't they do this? David, you know this story. I walked into a room with Sid Vicious, 6'9", with the baby face who was 5'8" at best, meaning Benoit, and asked them to put Benoit over clean. Sometimes it's a lot, and he bitched and moaned and fought. Why am I putting a midget over? What is wrong with you? Sometimes, you know, it isn't as easy as it sounds. Plus, Hulk had that creative control, so I had to get really close to him where he trusted me. And you're absolutely right, you know. And it was in my head the worst time of my life professionally going to the ring because I felt like I was coming out of the clown car.
Right, but you had to gain that trust, and that was important.
Yeah.
And I remember that. Speaking of Chris Benoit, you had a feud with him that turned into a bit of a shoot, as they say in the business. What are your memories about that?
Here's the thing that a lot of people didn't realize is you knew I had two. I had a bunch of homes in Daytona, but I had a home in the Keys. And right. Nancy and I had fallen apart, and I was living in the Keys for 8 months before this thing happened. I never thought it would be Benoit because he had just had a 2-week-old baby.
Right.
You remember that, right, David?
Yeah, he lived in Peachtree City. We talked about it with Justin Roberts, the whole Benoit saga on our first episode that we did here. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was a sad state of affairs because her mother and I still talk. Her sister and I still talk. The mother and father lost. Not only did they lose a daughter and a grandchild, they can never, the other sister, Sandra, can't have grandchildren. And the other family, the Benoit's family, his mother and father, their life is, you know, that's like PTS shock. And I'm sure his children have been not given the easiest time in life. And it was a horrible, horrible thing. And for people to say in my head that, you know, he should be in Hall of Fame, you know, her sister is a staunch, you know, one to say if his brain was so mush, I didn't know how to get to the airport. You were there.
It's funny. I never spoke to her sister, but I said the very same thing to Chris Jericho when that all went down. And I didn't mean to go there. I was just talking about the shoot work that you had with Chris.
Right.
But yeah, if we're going to talk about it, I didn't buy that part either. You can't book hotels and rent a cars and all that stuff if your mind is mush. You just can't function. Unfortunately, when my grandmother was 101, she lost her functions and she had to go into a home and she didn't recognize anybody. And I'm sorry, you could say what you want. And the whole thing is an absolute tragedy across the board. But I agree. You can't function and be unfunctionable at the same time. So, one has
to. And the other thing, David, that I've learned as I've gotten older in life, life is so precious. And to lose my mother-in-law, My wife's younger sister OD'd, okay? And we're not sure if her husband did it. because he was her doctor and prescribing the pills he shouldn't have been prescribing. And he said that she had, you know, what's that disease that women get now? Fibromyalgia.
Yeah.
That she had that, and no one, she was the worst case he ever saw. But he was giving her 800 Oxy-80s a month, plus Percocet and Valium in a portal to her heart. And he called and said, I can't find her. I went over the house and I found her. And my mother-in-law, this is 7 years ago.
This is your current wife's mother.
Yeah, has never been the same. When it happened, she was living here with her younger daughter. I brought her to Florida, and it almost drove the whole family nuts, because that's all they talked about every waking hour. And I believe that life is such a short trip that you got to enjoy the most you can and try to do as little pain as you possibly can do on your way through this journey.
I agree. 1,000%.
Yeah.
Okay, moving forward on a more positive note. So, well, I don't know if this is a more positive note. So Eric leaves. Any other memories of WCW, Monday Night Wars, Monday Nitro? It seemed that because I was close to you and we rode together sometimes and had a cocktail afterwards sometimes. And it seemed like as you brought more of this top talent on, Piper and Ultimate Warrior and had all this talent that was coming over, it seemed like it was harder and harder to get the shows done because you know, people had their own agendas, if I'm being honest. And you know, so tell me about how hard that was for you, because you know, you were trying to solve 14 people's problems so they go out on live TV and do a watered down version of what you had written because they didn't want to do what you had written. So how frustrating was that?
And you know that Hogan had creative control, Piper had creative control. I had enough respect for Kevin and Scott to listen to them, because their bitches were usually the baby faces, just want to go over with no heat. And then they would get there. I'd leave the show on the first flight Tuesday back to Atlanta, do the show, send it to everybody. Everybody approved it. And on Monday, Hogan would redo the show a half hour before the program.
Right. I remember it well.
Yeah. And it was a scramble. As long as they let me do it, it was not saying that it was that I had a system and the system worked. What they saw was, oh, I'm not getting enough TV time here. I got to do this. The greatest one was, I remember I said, no fighting outside the ring. And I think you remember this. I said, no fighting outside the ring, because we've got a big melee at the end with the NWO. Diamond Dallas Page is wrestling, I think, Scott Norton. He goes out of the ring. He goes up to the second tier, and there are lights already set up there. And I flipped. I called Keith and I said, what the hell's going on, Keith? He said, he said he got it okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It was pretty wild. It was out of control at one point. And you know, I look back at WCW and thankfully, as with a lot of things in life, the bad memories and the craziness, I don't remember all that much. And, you know, I remember the good times, but there were some pretty crazy times. And I was just a ring announcer. So you being the guy trying to hold the glue together, I can't even imagine how you kept your sanity.
Well, and you were very good about it because at that time I was losing my marbles. And I remember one time, and you said to me, I taught you a lesson. I stopped on the I-5 freeway in San Francisco and said, get out. Don't tell me you don't know. You know what happened. And you always said that if you make a mistake, admit to it. And, you know, you helped me a lot. Arn Anderson helped me a lot. Teddy Long helped me a lot. But there was only so much you guys could do. And then I was starting to think, why? Oh, and then I'll never forget this. And I'm not talking about school. You know, Craig and what was his girlfriend's name?
Craig. Oh, well, here we go. I'm sorry, Craig, in advance. Craig Leathers and Annette Yother. Oh, here we go.
Yeah.
It's on. Okay. Go for it.
She told Eric how smart she was and that she was doing the show. You remember that?
Yes.
And I said, oh, I'll show them. I put a piece of paper down in front of them. And I said, I'll be back in 2 hours. They didn't even write segment one. You know what I mean? And that's what started to happen. Everybody was jockeying for position. Because there was a lot of money being made. Everybody thought it was going to go on forever.
Right.
And they didn't understand what the meaning of that merger meant. It was our death knell. You know it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up because I talk about not remembering the bad things. You're right. It wasn't, you know, everybody talks about how the talent was out of control. You know, there was production people jockeying, you know, for positions, trying to bury each other, making, I'm not mentioning any names, but, you know, making unholy alliances. It was, you know, like you said, there was a ton of money on the table and, you know, everybody's running hard, you know, and, you know, it was, it got crazy at one point. That's why I was just happy to be a little underling, you know, I would have liked to have thought that if WCW was still alive today that I'd be a senior VP of something. But back then I was just glad to be there and not have to have a title other than ring announcing.
Oh, yeah, and like you said, that there was unholy alliances. Somebody in production told me that Paul Orndorff was undermining. And Paul and I go back way back, and I was there the night that Paul kicked Vader in the face. So I didn't want that to happen to me, and I pulled Paul aside. I said, hey, listen, we need to have a talk. And I said, is this what's going on? And it was the reverse. And David, you know, you saw it in a different light. Maybe they hit it more for me than you, but you saw it constantly. It was like, oh, God. You know, it was like, not only did they want to choke the golden goose, they wanted to put M80s up his ass and blow him off completely, you know?
Yeah, it got out of control. Which leads me to Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara being brought up. Were you, refresh my memory, were you still the booker when they were hired to be the head writers?
No, I was told. I got a phone call by J.J. Dillon. I'll never forget. Bill Bush had become boss. J.J. called me.
Just to give the fans a background who may not know, he was an accountant with the company. Great guy, great money guy, and the nicest guy in the world, but not exactly. Yeah. And he would self-admit even back then that he wasn't the guy to run a company, but he was basically put in charge to get the finances under control, correct?
Right, and he was a wonderful human being.
Nicest guy in the world.
JJ calls me and said, listen, can I talk to you about something? I said, yeah. He said, listen, Ferrara and Russo became available, and we hired them. I said, fine. That's great. Great. I said, but what does that mean for me? He said, we're going to still pay you, and we're going to extend your contract. I said, that's fine. Let him do it. And after about 2 weeks, JJ said to me, would you mind coming to these meetings?
So you had a 2-week reprieve. It's not even enough to not even enough to sleep the amount of hours you probably needed to sleep to catch up.
Yeah, he said, would you mind coming? I said, JJ, I just want to do a little fishing down the Keys. I said, isn't that important? He said, yeah, I want you to come. And JJ, you know, he was my direct boss. I said, okay, I'll come. And he said, I said, what do you want? And he said, I just want you to watch the show. I said, do you want to go to the production meeting? He said, yeah, it'll look funny if you don't. So I go to the production meeting. And then I go and watch the show. And I go and see him the next day at TBS. And he said, what do you think? I said, this is a pilot for a series called Rope Opera. This can't be wrestling. And I said, do you remember the Italian group of guys that threw meatballs on Booker T and Stevie Ray? I said, you're going to get an Italian defamation league.
Oh, yes.
And I think they think I called. They called. You couldn't do that kind of stuff. And the thing about burying Rick in the desert, how Freudian is that? Bury him alive, right?
Right.
I mean, it was so badly done. And, you know, one of the things I've read about history, it was about when Hitler was taking over. Goebbels could have stopped them, but he let it go. And sometimes not making any action is worse. Because I had this thing with my partner, M, and he said, well, Ed, it could have been worse if Ed didn't keep him in check. And I said, how could it be any worse? Viagra on a pole match? Think about that. Viagra on a pole match? And then he said this thing about Ginger. Well, they're not pushing him as a champion the way they should be. This guy changed the belt 4 times in 2 hours, made an actor the world heavyweight champion, and made himself the world heavyweight champion.
I will say, in defense of David Arquette, he did buy the entire bar that night. So I give him. I thought that was very classy, and I appreciated that move.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what else is classy about him. Do you know that they paid him quite a bit. You know that, right?
Yeah, and he gave it all to charity, if I remember correctly.
He gave it to Brian Pillman's family.
Oh, I did. I knew it was a charity. I didn't realize that. Wow. Yeah, he was a classy guy. He didn't, you know, he gets a bad rap on that. But I talked to him, and I became friendly with him at the time, and he didn't think he deserved that any more than anybody else thought he deserved it, probably less. But
yeah.
You always got to appreciate a guy who buys the entire bar for the entire night.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, this is cop TV. People don't care about wrestling. Well, what are you trying to tell me? They don't care about football. They don't care about baseball. They don't care about this Conor McGregor Mayweather fight. I mean, people, sometimes I say to myself, is there something loose up there? And I don't believe in my heart that he did when they had Austin and The Rock hot in the Attitude Era. The only thing I ever saw him do was make Steve Austin a heel, playing the guitar, and The Rock singing. And on the other side, on WCW, he made Goldberg run from the ring from Booker T.
I wanted to ask you, I'm glad you brought up Goldberg, because you were instrumental in that whole super push that became look at what happened at WrestleMania this year. 20 years later, it became a phenomenon again. Tell me when you saw Bill, what your thoughts were, and and whose idea it was to do the win streak and how that came together.
Okay. I bet you don't even know this. And you announced the match. I beat Bill Goldberg on Nitro with Steve McMichaels over the Super Bowl ring when Goldberg wore the Falcon jacket and the red tights and the red boots. Do you remember that?
Barely.
Nobody remembers it. I kept him off TV for 8 weeks, shaved his head, gave him the Mike Tyson short boots, the black tights, breathing fire like a dragon, and put him on the winning streak. Because I had read one time, Primo Carnera, who was the world champion, heavyweight boxing champion in the 30s and early 40s, got into wrestling, and his gimmick was he had 141 wins before he wrestled Luthez for the world title. They drew a huge house in Montreal, and he did a job.
You know, the thing I like about you, Kevin, is that you know, a lot of people tell story. You know, like to change history. Oh, this was my idea. This was my idea. But the thing about you is, you're a smart guy, a brilliant guy, and you not only say I had this idea, but you say why I had this idea, because nobody would make up the fact that you based that on a boxer from the 1930s, unless it was true. So, you know, you not saying anything negative about anybody else, but you know, you have a reason why you do everything, and or something that gives you the idea, and you remember those reasons. So it just adds a lot of credibility to what you say versus what other people might say.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So that's the Bill Goldberg. I want to make sure we get what I wanted to get in before we let you go finally. So Russo and Ed got sent home, and
right.
Bill Bush, if I remember correctly, brought you back, and there was that was why you put the title on Benoit. There were some people that thought that that their pushes under Russo were going to go away, and you wanted to try to prove that you were doing what's good for business. And
I can remember you and I sitting in that building and me saying, I'm going to offer him the Olive Branch tonight. Do you think he'll accept it? And you said, absolutely. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I thought he would. I was friendly with those guys, as you know, and I was friendly with you.
Yeah.
I thought that they would, that, you know, look, the world title is a big deal. And, you know, everything that you guys had been through personally and professionally and the disagreements that you had, I thought that that was a perfect way to show that you were, you know, you were ready to play ball and give those guys their due. I was disappointed actually that of what happened. But how was that to deal with? Tell us about your memories of them walking out after you had given Chris the world title the next day.
Well, you know, I had given Eddie the U.S. belt.
Right.
And the cruiserweight belt at the same time, and Dean beat Eddie for the cruiserweight belt, and I was going to make Satin and Dean the world tag team champions on the next TV. When I was giving him the finish, and Sid was bitching about it, but he agreed to do it, something just clicked in my head. And when I looked at Chris, I said, I'm going to tell you exactly how long you're going to have the belt. You're going to have the belt for 6 months. Then you're going to lose it to Nash, because by that time, I believe the NWO should be ready to be a baby face. And by that time, I think you'll be a real good heel. And he knew it. And he said, thank you. Shook my hand. And then something happened to me when I looked in his eye. I said, now when you tap out, I made him tap out, if you remember, right?
Said, yeah.
I said, make sure one of your legs is underneath the bottom rope.
Right.
I did it that night because he wouldn't stay for the next night. Remember, we used to do Thursday. That was Monday. He wouldn't stay to Thursday to put the belt on back on Sid.
Right.
I said, that was the saving grace. I just came up with that, and I don't know why I did it, but I did.
You just had a feeling that they weren't going to go with it, huh?
Yeah, I just had a feeling that it wasn't just me they wanted fired. They wanted me, JJ, and Mike Graham. And then Mike was the one that instigated the whole thing, where he said, if you guys try to get me fired, I'll cut everyone, beat up every one of you. And they went to call to Human Resources. And JJ came to Mike and said, why'd you say you're going to beat him up? And he said, you got to be shitting me. They called and said that. So anyway.
I remember that night like it was yesterday. I can't remember the city we were in, but I can remember the setup of the building.
Yeah, I can too. They had the, remember they had the bleachers and the whole thing. Yeah.
I begged them as they were walking out, and way before that, I begged them to sleep on it. And look, I guess for their careers, you know, bless them. I guess you know, for the most part, right. It worked out. It worked out. You know, world champions were created, and guys got, you know, made a lot of money. So, you know, but at the time, I was really hoping that they would give you guys an opportunity to really push them the way they wanted to be pushed. The ironic part is everything that they ever wanted was coming true, and they walked away from it. I had forgotten about the Mike Graham part, and I'm sure that didn't help. So
no.
So Russo comes back. Eric comes back. Were you still there at that time, or you?
No, I just signed a 3-year contract, and I went home.
And that was it. That was, how did you find out that WWE bought WCW?
What was his name? The executive on the North Tower, his niece used to work, the one, Emily, what was her name?
Sherman. It was Brad...
Siegel.
Brad Siegel.
He called me and said, you don't need to be on TV anymore. I said, why? He said, we've been bought and we're going with somebody else. Until we've been bought, you don't have to come. And I said, fine. And that was it.
What were you thinking at that point after putting your heart and soul and losing half your mind, you know, creating that and trying to hang on to it and thing was being sold away. What was your feeling about that?
Well, my feeling was I was going to be paid for 3 years.
There you go.
And they called me about 6 weeks into it when I guess Russo and Eric weren't getting along. And they said, we'd like you to come back. And I said, what's the compensation? They said, what do you mean? I said, well, how much more am I going to make? They said, you make what you make. I said, so let me get this right. I can fish every day or I can come to work every day. I said, I'll get back to you in a week. And I hung up.
And that was the last time you ever heard anything back from
them? Last time I ever heard anything back from them. Yep.
So I'm assuming you just took some time off. I know we all had to kind of decompress at that point.
Well, I took the 2 years off. Then I built the biggest gym in the Keys.
That's right.
I owned the biggest gym in the Keys, and I had a lobster business too there. So now, I kept myself pretty busy.
I have a question for you. How does a guy who's a Key West beach bum end up in the mountains of wherever you live in Oregon? How does that happen?
Well, I live in the islands. I live in the San Juan Islands in Seattle. Very similar. Not, it's colder the water, but we never get snow. I've had a house here for 15 years, been here permanently. If we do get snow, it's a quarter of an inch dusting, and some of the greatest diving in the world is here. We shrimp, we got crab traps. I fish for salmon. I'm not a big hunter anymore, but I do shoot an elk or a deer once a year just to load up the cabinet. So
it's like sort of the Keys Light. You still get to fish.
Yeah, it's the Keys Light. Absolutely. Yeah, it's the Keys Light. That's what it is exactly. Yeah, and I mean, I'm looking outside right now, outside of my house, on the right by Seattle, which is 75 miles away from me. I can see Mount Baker, and to the right of me, as you can hear the ferry. The right of me is Mount Baker, so I'm closer to Victoria Island than I am Seattle. I can be in Victoria Island by boat in 20 minutes.
Okay, so just to put a dot on the wrestling thing, and then if you don't mind just sticking around for a few more minutes, I have a couple of questions that fans sent in. But just to put a dot on things, were you ever offered an opportunity to go to WWE? If not, why do you think so? And if so, why did it never happen?
I talked to Vince a couple of times, and I gave him a couple of finishes, and he used them. And then I got a call from John Laurinaitis to meet with him and Stephanie, and I met with them. I probably came across cocky. I probably came across unprofessional. I came from, I said, I'm not going to fly to, at the time, I said, there's no sense in flying me to Stanford when you're here in Fort Lauderdale. I'll drive up from the Keys. Well, right. I had my shorts on. And my, you know, my Hawaiian shirt on. You know, we're Florida boys, David. We dress a little different, right?
Absolutely.
And I went in, and maybe that I didn't have a tie on of this, and Stephanie really didn't know who I was, and I was kind of taken back, and so it became between me and Ted DiBiase. She told me. Johnny had led me to believe it was my job. And she said, well, we're going to have to talk to you about Ted DiBiase or you. And she said, what do you think about Ted? I said, he's a great guy. He's a Christian. You can't go wrong. And she said, that's funny. He said the opposite about you. I said, well, we all have our faults, and he's probably right. I have not been a shining star my whole life, though. You know, and I never held it against him. I mean, he needed the job. I had opened the largest, David, I would open the largest gym, as you know, in the Keys. Right. A population of two towns was 3,000 people all year round, and I had 1,200
members.
I also, in the winter time, got about another 1,200 people, and I ran Pilates and dance classes. So we did well. We sold it, and I sold the lobster business. And it's funny, I got the lobster business because my friend was going to lose it. They're doing away with the lobster business because the Korea sold. They're going to the lobster business is a wooden box, right?
Right.
But it's soaked with creosote, which ruins the environment. Up here, the crab nets are made out of metal. so it doesn't hurt. So I ended up, my friend got in a little problem. A guy was stealing, and you know what hooker rig is? We go down 60 feet, and you don't have to decompress because it's not.
Right.
Okay. He caught a guy doing it, stealing from him, and we pulled the guy up. The guy's arm was in his trap, and he pulled the guy in the boat and just near killed him. And you can't have a trap if you got a felony charge or you're facing a felony charge. So money really never transpired, but he gave me 20% of his business for 5 years until I left. So I did pretty good there. So.
There you go. And you said Stephanie McMahon legitimately, when she walked in the room, didn't know who you were? Or do you think she didn't?
I don't know. She didn't realize. You know, she was a lot younger then.
That's true.
I'm sure, you know, they weren't talking about me. And, you know, but hey, let's talk about what they did. You know about your son saying that was the most ridiculous thing, right? With making him the champion?
Yeah, the Indian kid. Right.
David, we have 350 million people we know of, right?
Right.
They have 1,500,000. He's going into a virgin territory. He is going to end up, all of your people that listen to David's podcast are going to hear it here. He is going to end up drawing more money than anybody in the history of the WWE. Jakarta, there's India, right? And China, they go 1-2 with the population, right?
Right.
Jakarta is number 3. It's right down the road. He's one of them. I'm willing to bet that when he was doing jobs up there, they edited those matches out. This was not, we did this by the fly of our pants. When people talk about the WF and they say to me, well, they don't do this, they don't do that. This is the NFL. This is the NFL. They have extremely smart people running it, okay? And now I'm going to tell you the biggest thing that's ever happened in the history of the wrestling business. You ready?
What's that?
Mrs. McMahon being on the cabinet as head of the Small Business Administration, a wrestling family. You know who the McMahons are? Who? They're the Kennedys of the millennium.
Wow. Well, if Stephanie didn't know who you were before, she'll know who you are now, because you just gave them a huge compliment. But yeah, well, they do. Look, I know they do extensive market research. They don't just fly by the seat of their pants. Ultimately, right. It's Vince's decision because it's his company, but. You know, they did extensive market research, for what I understand, to people close to the company that showed that India was prime for the picking right now. And look, TNA just taped in India. So, you know, it's no coincidence that the wrestling fans, the people there are ready to embrace sports entertainment, professional wrestling. And why not appeal to, like you said, the huge amount of sitting. Captured audience that they have right there. So
yeah, and I would tell you what I would do, and they can do this if they want, right? Do you know the history of Pakistan, David?
No, I know you do, though. You're a big history guy. Okay. I'd like for you and my 20-year-old son to talk history. He's a big history buff, too. Maybe when you come down here for our Fan Fest. By the way, don't forget CWF Legends Fan Fest 2, Saturday, October 28th. Here in Odessa, rural Tampa, Florida. Go to CWF FanFest on, type that in on eventbrite.com. You could come and meet Kevin Sullivan and JJ Dillon, to just to name a few. We're capped at 200 tickets. We will not sell 201. This is an intimate fan fest, and got rave reviews for the first one with the Assassin, Steve Kern, Bugsy McGraw, and many more. So I wanted to get that plug in. You could you could join up for the CWF Archives Facebook page. My partner is the man who runs that page, and or you could go to Eventbrite.com and type in CWF Fan Fest. It'll pop right up. And just a little plug for another thing that I'm doing. But go ahead now. The angle that you're giving them.
Okay.
Pakistan. That's where we were.
Pakistan was part of India. After England gave Pakistan its independence with Gandhi, Gandhi realized that there was going to be a problem because India was Muslim. India was Hindu. That part of India was 90% Muslim. They broke it away and made it their own country. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say it's like Palestine and Israel, okay, but it's very close. It got like the Irish and the English, okay.
Mm-hmm.
They need to find a good-looking Pakistani and make him a heel, and they'll draw big money. David, there used to be a guy. His name was King Kong. He wrestled Luthez over there. They drew over 200,000 people in La Jolla.
Wow.
India, wrestling is the number one sport. So, it's easy for these guys to say, oh, they made a mistake. And when they draw the big money, they're going to say, oh, yeah, what a great idea they had. you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I understand.
Hey, and the other thing was, Vince McMahon owned the Cape Cod Coliseum, and the head of the Small Business Administration was making meatball sandwiches in the cafeteria there and selling them to the fans that went to wrestling or hockey. They've come a long way. They've been very successful. It sounds like I'm kissing their ass. But David, without them, none of us would have made the money we did. And what they've accomplished in politics is unheard of for a professional wrestler.
Absolutely. People ask me why I'm such a big fan of capitalism. Well, that's why, because a lady who was making meatball sandwiches and selling them to the hockey fans and wrestling fans is now the head of the Small Business Administration. You've said it perfectly. I got a couple questions for you before I let you go. First question is from a big fan of yours, actually, is Nick Gator, at Nick Gator on Twitter. He says he has a non-wrestling question. How, quote-unquote, real was your appearance on Not Geo's The Legend of Mick Dodge? I know that you're very well known for that, your appearances on that show recently. Yeah. So tell me how, quote-unquote, real that was.
He was the complete shoot. He lived in a cave in the winter before they found him. I mean, in the summer, and he lived in a redwood stump where he had his bookcase and he had a fireplace where probably four or five people could stand up, okay? The other guy, Craig, he had a bunch of property, and he was great at making clothes, and him and Mick were friends. Now, everybody else there was at work. They brought me over. I don't live in that part of Washington. It's beautiful. It's the only rainforest in North America. They brought me over there. They get like 12 feet of rain a year, Dave. 12 feet. Yeah, and they brought me over there, and I and the other guy that was legit, there's a small, they lived, the town where he lived in the woods, but the town that was closest, you might have heard of it, it was Falk, F-O-L-K, that's where they did the series Twilight, the vampire series.
Right, right.
And there's another little town called Oil City, and the guy there was the mayor of Oil City, and Oil City was like 400 people, but he was the number one fishing guide in that part of Washington. So I got to go and fish with him a bunch of times, so it was cool.
So basically, he was a shoot, the rest of the, they were building stories around him, is what was happening.
Right, right. Like, I'll give you an example. In the winter time, he didn't show this on TV, but he would set up, and then they built him a cabin in the wilderness so he'd have it, and they paid him a bunch of money, and he gave a lot of it away for different things, but he would snag elk, and he would, you know, get an elk and a deer, and he lived off the land. He was quite a character, and he still is. He was a third-generation Marine that went to Vietnam and grew up in Osaka.
God bless.
Yeah.
All right, a couple more questions. Yeah. There's a real Twitter handle called at 20 years of Nitro. So 20 years of Nitro would like to know, and we hit on this a little bit, but I thought it was an interesting question. Were there any specific assurances regarding booking and angles that you had to give Hulk to convince him to go through with the big turn? Did you have to promise him anything, or had you, as we spoke about earlier, just gained his trust enough that he was willing to go with you?
Yeah. I gained his trust enough, and other times afterwards, you know, I can't do that one today, baby. You know, especially if it had something to do with Savage. There was some unusual, as you knew, David, there was some very unusual heat there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and last one, at Total Mark for Wrestling is the Twitter handle. Favorite feud you ever had in your entire career? I don't know if you could nail it down. He said ever. I asked him twice.
Dusty
down here as the devil?
Yeah, I wrestled Dusty for 3 years, almost every night. And it was so entertaining. He would come up with great finishes every night. And we'd be able to go back, you know. I was either wrestling Dusty by myself, or I wrestle him and Jack in a tag match with Marky, or we'd be in a six-man with Ken, Barry, Blackjack, and Dusty against me, Roop, and Mark. So I had a wonderful time. Plus, I was home in Florida.
There you go. All right, I want to thank the fans for questions. I want to also mention that, Kevin, you have your own podcast with Mr. St. Laurent on the MLW Radio Network, mlwradio.com. They have a ton of great content. And so be sure to follow Kevin. I know that I know a lot of people who are huge fans. I've not been able to figure out how to listen to podcasts other than when I sit and have to listen to my own. So I'm about to get on an international flight to on Tuesday to Greece. And so I have to figure out how to download some podcasts so I can catch up on what I'm missing. Because I heard there's
What are you doing in Greece, David?
Well, I actually was going to, I'll make the announcement now. I actually was going to mention that at the end of the show, and this is almost the end of this podcast, that I had told my wife when we got married or shortly thereafter that for our 25th wedding anniversary, I would take her on her dream trip to Greece, Santorini, Mykonos, and Athens.
Who
the hell would ever think that she'd take me up on it 25 years later? I would have thought she threw my ass to the street, you know, 10 years ago, but you know, maybe she will when we get back. She just stuck around for the trip. So I will be leaving for 10 days to take my lovely bride to celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary in Greece. And so next week there will not be a podcast. So we're going to take 1 week off and come back and do have bigger and better guests. But I don't know that we're going to be able to get bigger and better than what I just taped over the last 2 weeks. Kevin, my appreciation is tremendous to you giving us not only the time, but your honesty and the stories, because in my mind, and I don't think anybody would argue with this, you're one of the top 10 influential people in the history of this entire business. So to have you here on City Ringside, this little podcast that we're trying to build, is an absolute honor. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much, David, and good luck, and have a wonderful time in Greece.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Doesn't get much better than that. Like I said just a moment ago, in my mind, one of the top 10 most influential people in the history of professional wrestling. And I think today, in this week's version, he showed, told a lot of stories about why that is. And I appreciate Kevin taking the time. He's well sought after. And living semi-retirement, doing wrestling, non-wrestling appearances around the country and around the world, including mine that we already plugged, and we'll plug more throughout the coming weeks and months. Want to remind you, as I just mentioned, we will not have a show drop on the 31st of July. I do apologize. I will be out of the country. I didn't want to literally just phone something in. So we do encourage you, if you're a new fan, we can go back and check out my interview with Justin Roberts, my interview with Nick Patrick that an entire paragraph was written about in the Wrestling Observer newsletter, are on assignment at Universal Studios. Some great interviews with Earl Hebner, Tyrus, Jeff Jarrett, and a short promo from Conan. And part one of my interview with Kevin, where he talks about his career and learning to book from Vince McMahon Sr. And, so many great angles and stories of the territorial days, which I'm still a big fan of. So we encourage you to listen to those if on the 31st, if you haven't already, and then I'll be back the following week. And we're working on some really interesting guests. So again, at David Penzer on Twitter or at Penzer Ringside on Twitter, we'd love for you to follow both, and love for you to let us know what you think of the podcast. If you like it, if there's things you don't like about it, I'm a big boy. I've been in the wrestling business 25 years. You're not going to hurt my feelings, but it will let us know what people are digging and what they might not be digging so much. So I do appreciate all the feedback that we get, and looking for more feedback to come. So until next time, in 2 weeks from today, this is David Penzer. I'll be sitting ringside, but right now I'm on my way to Athens.
Follow David Penzer on Twitter at David Penzer. Also, make sure to follow the show on Twitter at Penzer Ringside. You've been sitting ringside with David Penzer on Radio Influence. Radio Influence brings you the absolute best in digital audio broadcasting. We've got something for everyone. Sports personalities like the Fabulous Sports Babe, Rich Herrera, and former Major League Baseball manager Kevin Kennedy, as they take you inside the dugout. We'll take you inside the world of MMA with the MMA Report with Jason Floyd, the MMA Insiders, and the Valor Hour with Tim Loy and Casey Oxidine. Or you could find yourself sitting ringside with wrestling ring announcer David Penzer. TV law enforcement analyst and former police officer Vincent Hill breaks down this week's biggest crime stories and takes you beyond the badge. Chef Brian Duffy from TV's Bar Rescue shares his crazy life on the road with Duffified Live. And Scott Ledger will always make you think with some dangerous conversation. All of Radio Influence's shows can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.